Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. Anti-war and anti-nuke activist Bruce Gagnon spoke near Hartford, Connecticut on August 20th, 2011, and I was there to record it. Today we'll hear the first half of that talk. Bruce said some new things in that talk, and he offered an analysis of U.S. military, political, and economic strategies that I think was just brilliant and very persuasive. The purpose of war is to enrich the military-industrial complex and to plunder other people's resources for the benefit of the oligarchs. And the technique stays pretty much the same. The lies the government told about Gaddafi are the same lies it told about Saddam Hussein, Vietnam, and you can trace it back to the lies told about Crazy Horse in 1877. And Bruce does. Here's Bruce Gagnon.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me. It's great to be here with you all. I drove down from Maine. I don't know how familiar you all are with the global network. It was created in 1992. At that time, I was living in Florida and working for the Florida Coalition for Peace and Justice. And we had been working on space issues. And we saw in 92 that the whole idea of moving the arms race into space was speeding up dramatically and getting worse by the minute. And the only really two groups in the country that were doing much work on it were the Florida Coalition and then our friends in Colorado, a group called Citizens for Peace and Space in Colorado Springs, where the Space Command is headquartered at that time. And so we put our heads together and created the global network in 92. And today it's made up of 150 different groups all over the world, because as the U.S. is trying to create the Star Wars system, they put all these military satellites in space that orbit the Earth. And as they orbit the Earth, they send their signals down just below where they are at the time. And so the Pentagon has had to establish bases literally all over the planet, receiving or downlink stations that are talking to the satellites to help Star Wars program. And so that's really the bulk of our membership now, are these groups all over the planet. So each year we meet in a different country, in a different part of the world. In June we had our 19th annual meeting. We met actually in Massachusetts, in Andover, because that's where Raytheon is. And Raytheon is a key player in this whole program to move the arms race into space. All warfare on the Earth today is coordinated by space technology. In fact, in this planning document called Vision for 2020, put out by the Space Command, on the back you see the Earth sitting on this little pedestal, and you see that they really connect it all. They say no matter whether you're a troop on the ground, in a tank, on a boat, on a plane, whatever you're doing, all warfare is now coordinated by space technology. And so the Pentagon says whoever controls space then will literally win all the wars on the Earth below. But I want to digress for a minute and go back and just tell a story that I think really kind of helped inform me about what the military-industrial complex in this country was really all about. Think back to the 1860s, just after the Civil War. After that Civil War was over, the Army really then began in earnest to finish up the job of decimating and destroying the native populations out west. All the way from the Canadian border in the country's heartland through the Dakotas, south through Colorado, on down into northern Texas and New Mexico, Arizona, that whole area. These were the last of the quote-unquote renegades at that time. And into the 1870s and 1880s, there was a policy undertaken to send out buffalo hunters and to kill every buffalo that they could find. Sometimes they would just ride along in trains and shoot out the window. And they had these new high-powered rifles that could shoot the length of about 15 football fields at that time. And so they were just taking pot shots at these buffalo. Sometimes they would go and take the hides and just let everything else just sit there and rot. Sometimes they didn't even bother taking the hides at all. But the idea was one way to exterminate the native people was to destroy their food source. And so slowly, the last of the bands, whether they were Comanches in northern Texas or the Lakota up in South Dakota, they were slowly but surely brought onto the reservation. And one of the last two bands to come onto the reservation were Crazy Horse, who finally gave up in 1877, and then Sitting Bull in 1881, the last two of the Lakota holdouts, and brought finally onto the reservation. They didn't want to do it, but they did it because they were relentlessly being chased 365 days a year by the U.S. Army, and their food source had been decimated. They had been given the lands of the Black Hills in western South Dakota by treaty, told that it would be their land as long as the grass grew green. But gold was discovered there, and so quickly the native people had to be removed even from that last part of the world that they called the Pajasapa, the heart of the earth. Well, Crazy Horse, when he was brought onto the reservation in 1877, he had to give up his horses and his guns, virtually his entire way of life. And what happened as he was sitting in his teepee on the reservation without a horse and a gun, the military-industrial complex, those that were supplying the weapons to the U.S. Army for this war effort, saw a real drop in their profits. And they weren't very happy about it. And so they created a national media campaign where they got artists to do renderings of Crazy Horse back on the warpath. And they planted these stories in major newspapers all over America. These artist renderings of Crazy Horse going back and killing white people, raping women, killing children, taking the scalps of all these innocent white Americans. And suddenly the nation was outraged as they were led to this mythology by the media at the time. When in fact, Crazy Horse was sitting on the inside of his teepee back on the reservation in South Dakota with no horse and no gun. Well, Congress quickly swung into action because they were hearing from all the American people that you've got to do something to stop these renegades, these savages. And so they appropriated more money for the war out west, for the military-industrial complex. When I read that story, it all began to make more sense to me. That in my own lifetime, having grown up in a military family, my dad was in the Air Force, I was a young Republican for Nixon in 68. I came from a right-wing conservative family. I wanted to be like my dad. I tried to join the Air Force in 71. I flunked my induction physical because of an old high school football injury. So I had to get a waiver to get into the military when most people of good sense were trying to get waivers to stay out of the military. Well, after my training, I was sent to a base in California that was an airlift base for the war in Vietnam. And GIs would come from all over the country to get on planes to go to Vietnam. And many times they would refuse to go. And so there was a lot of anti-war activity inside the base and also outside the base on weekends. And as it turned out, my first roommate, when I checked into the barracks on my first day, you know, this guy, you report to what's called an orderly room to check in. He looks down his roster and he says, "Oh my God, I can't believe it. We've only got one room left. I'm really sorry, man. We'll get you out of there as soon as we can. Get your bags and follow me," he said. We walked down this long, dark hallway, last door on the left, and he kept apologizing. "Really, man, I promise we'll get you out of here quickly." And I thought it would be a little broom closet with a cot, something like that. And he opened the door, and we walked in, and there were anti-war posters all over the wall. As it turns out, it was one of the leading organizers in the GI resistance movement in the barracks, and they were keeping him isolated because they wanted to kick him out. They didn't have enough goods on him yet, but they ran out of room. And so they put me in there, and then they forgot all about me. And so at night there would be a knock on the door, And white guys would come in with chairs and they would sit in a circle and talk about the war in Vietnam. And me, the young Republican, sitting in the corner thinking, oh my God, these have to be communists, you know. And I've heard of communists before, you know. And another night there was a knock on the door and black guys came in with chairs. And they would sit in a circle and they were Black Panthers from the cities talking about racism in America. And they were, every time, whether they were white or they were black, they were all smoking pot. And I'm sitting in the corner, you know. I'd heard of marijuana before. And I promise you, I never, ever inhaled. Never did. But I think it was maybe the secondhand smoke. It had some kind of an effect on me. And it kind of, my life changed. I eventually moved my chair into the circle. Began reading the literature that they would leave in our room. And became, as what they labeled me on my job, a royal pain in the ass, as I joined the GI resistance movement. My life was ever changed. And then, towards the end of my time in the Air Force, when the Pentagon Papers came out, that secret history of how the U.S. government fabricated the pretext to start the war in Vietnam, released by Daniel Ellsberg, here I am reading it on my job, with my feet on my desk, and a sign of, you know, rebellion against the military, and saying to myself, my God, they lied. They lied and they cheated. They stole. Total corruption. And it was the same thing. They did the same thing that they had done back in 1877 when Crazy Horse was inside of his tent. And then we saw it again in 2003 when the Bush administration, with the complicity of the Democrats and the Congress, fabricated the whole pretext for shock and awe over Iraq. And now today we see it continue in Afghanistan, where admittedly they tell us there's only 100 Al-Qaeda running through the mountainside, but we have all these NATO forces there and now expanding the war into Pakistan. And even in Libya, another pretext. Libya has the largest supplies of oil on the African continent. They have an administration or a government that doesn't want to comply with corporate globalization, and so they have to be taken out. And so we just see over and over and over again this, what I like to call modus operandi, MO. Because when I was a kid, also I wanted to be an FBI agent. I wanted to fight organized crime. My mother's family from Connecticut, Shelton, Connecticut, by the way, Italian family. And I was very sensitive about all the projection of Italian people as being mafia. And so I was very sensitive about that. I wanted to fight organized crime in order to give the Italian people, you know, some positive. So I took a correspondence course. I thought I'd get a head start on everybody else. And one of the, you know, I learned about fingerprints. Everybody has their own kind of fingerprint. But also, they sent me a list of definitions, FBI kind of definitions. And one of them that I'll never forget was MO, modus operandi. Every criminal has an MO. And so today, I've realized that I am fighting organized crime. And that this criminal syndicate that runs our country today, that is in charge of our country, and now has not only global ambitions, but intergalactic ambitions, if you will, okay, through the U.S. Space Command, that these people have to be stopped because they're doing nothing but destroying life on the planet, impoverishing the people, all the people of the planet, and in the saddest sense, leading to endless, endless war and suffering all over this beautiful Mother Earth. So that's what I do today. I'm a total crime fighter, a fighter against corruption. Some years ago, it's probably been about 5-6 years ago, I was watching one of my favorite television programs, C-SPAN. And they introduced this guy by the name of Thomas Barnett, who at that time was an instructor at the Naval War College in Rhode Island. It was a huge auditorium full of people in uniforms, generals, colonels, high-level military people. Also, the announcer said CIA people were there, top-level CIA people. And they introduced Barnett as Donald Rumsfeld's strategy guy and said he was going to be laying out in a 3-hour presentation the strategy for the future. And I said, oh, my God, I better take notes. So I ran and I got a pen and paper, and I sat there for the next 3 hours enthralled by this presentation, where basically he said the following. Because of corporate globalization, there's part of the world that is not submitting to the authority of the corporate globalists, corporate capital. And he said it's called the non-integrating gap. The non-integrating gap. And he laid out where this was. He said it's the Middle East, where, of course, we still are today, with about 50,000 troops and untold numbers of corporate mercenaries in Iraq. Central Asia, where we are today, establishing permanent bases in Afghanistan. Africa, where he said, by the way, we'll be fighting 20 years from now. And that was only 5, 6, 7 years ago. I forgot the exact date I listened to this presentation. So we're ahead of schedule, you could say, because of the war in Libya. And then parts of Latin America. Well, of course, we have Venezuela, where Hugo Chavez is not doing what the oil majors would like him to do, which is to surrender the resources of his country to the British and American petroleum companies. And he said, our job in the future, under corporate globalization, will not be to make shoes and cars and refrigerators and clothes and chairs. No, he said, we're going to send those jobs overseas where corporations can maximize profits. Our job, he said, under corporate globalization, will be security export. And thus, it's no coincidence that today, the number one industrial export product of America is what? Weapons. When weapons are your number one industrial export product, what is your global marketing strategy for that product line? Yeah, war, the more the better, the longer the better, the more profits that are made. And so this is what Barnett then laid out was going to be our role, America's role in the world.
We're listening to Bruce Gagnon on New World Notes. He spoke near Hartford on August 20th. Bruce goes on to talk about the military's plan to control not only the world, but all of space as well. How will they pay for such a massive undertaking? By grabbing all the country's entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicare, and so on. And Congress is eager to assist. Sound far-fetched, even paranoid? Listen to the evidence Bruce brings forth. Back to Bruce Gagnon.
Now, one other bit of information that I want to plug in here. Probably about 10 years ago, one of the industry publications I subscribed to called Space News ran an editorial where they said, look, we've got to be good corporate citizens, speaking on behalf of the aerospace industry. We've got to send our lobbyists to Washington and come up with a secure funding source to pay for everything space. Because the Pentagon brags and the industry brags that Star Wars, the words we use to describe warfare and the militarization, weaponization of space, Star Wars will be the largest industrial project in the history of the planet Earth, they say. And so they've got to come up with a funding source, a dedicated funding source. And so they say we are. We're now working on it. We've sent our lobbyists to Washington to secure that funding source. And they said it's the entitlement programs, which officially in America are Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and what's left of the welfare program after Bill Clinton got finished with it. These are the programs that the military-industrial complex has identified for defunding in order to pay for endless war, for security export, to control the non-integrating gap around the world. And so today, as we look at what's going on in Washington, what do we actually see in motion? We see an attack upon what is left of the entitlement programs, what is left of social progress in America, an expansion of the militarization of space, the militarization of the earth, and endless war. We see in play their, if you will, vision for 2020. I want to read to you just a couple sentences out of this Space Command vision for 2020. First, they, under a section called Historical Perspective, they say this: historically, military forces have evolved to protect national interests and investments, both military and economic. During the rise of sea commerce, nations built navies to protect and enhance their commercial interests. During the westward expansion of the continental United States, military outposts and cavalry emerged to protect our wagon trains, settlements, and railroads. Likewise, space forces will emerge to protect military and commercial national interests in the space medium due to their increasing importance. Under a section called Future Trends, they say, although unlikely to be challenged by a global peer competitor, the United States will continue to be challenged regionally. The globalization of the world economy will also continue with a widening between the haves and the have-nots. And then finally, they say, under a section called Control of Space, they say, control of space is the ability to assure access to space, freedom of operations within the space medium, and most importantly of all, I think they say, an ability to deny others the use of space. And in fact, at the headquarters building of the Air Force Space Command in Colorado Springs, right above their doorway, they have their logo that reads Master of Space. I like to call it Master of Disaster. So this is their plan that they're now putting in place, moving forward, and I would say again, with full cooperation of the Republicans and Democrats in the Congress of the United States. In recent days, we've heard about this new super committee in Congress, these 12 people that have essentially been put in place now of running the Congress. It's been like a coup d'etat where you've gone from 100 senators and 435 members of the House of Representatives to 12 members of the House and Senate now. So let's just take a look at who these people really are. I think it's quite interesting to note. The chair of the committee is Patty Murray, the senator from Washington State. She's called Boeing Senator. These 12 people chosen for the committee have taken roughly $1 million in war industry contributions since 2007. Patty Murray leads all 12. Senator Patty Murray, the Democrat from Washington State, leads all 12 with a take of $276,200 in campaign contributions since 2007. Who comes in second on the committee? Another Democrat, Max Baucus, from Montana, the guy that helped kill single payer during the fight in the Senate over health care. Democrat, $139,100 in campaign contributions from the military-industrial complex. Third in line is Dave Camp, a Republican from Michigan, $130,800. And the fourth is a guy from nearby, your neighboring state, Massachusetts, a guy by the name of John Kerry, Democrat, $73,500 in campaign contributions from the military-industrial complex since 2007. So three out of the top four recipients of corporate cash, corporate slush fund from the aerospace industry, from the military industry, are Democrats on this committee. So are these Democrats going to fight like hell and cut the military budget and make sure that Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid are not slashed, that welfare isn't completely eliminated? Are they going to do that on behalf of the American people, on behalf of poor people and working people in this country? I would submit to you the answer is absolutely no. This Boston Globe story came out just a few days ago on August 15th, entitled Doomsday Defense Cuts Directly Affect Panel Members. Talks about how oh my God, there's this talk that this new super committee is going to cut the military budget, that there's going to be equal sharing of all the cuts, you know. Oh my God, there'll be massive unemployment in America if we close these weapons production facilities down. They say that the state of Massachusetts is the fifth largest recipient of largesse from the Pentagon in the entire country. $8.37 billion last year. Connecticut, by the way, number four. They don't mention the total. I'm not sure of the total. The top state is Virginia. More money than any other state for Pentagon contracts. Then comes California. Then comes Texas. Then comes little old Connecticut. How did that happen? Have anything to do with a guy by the name of Lieberman, you think? And then Massachusetts. I love that. You ever hear that debate, you know, between the guy from Georgia and Massachusetts and the floor of the House? This congressman from Georgia kept referring to Massachusetts in his speeches. And a congressman from Massachusetts gets up and says, I just want to say to the representative from Georgia that it's not Massachusetts, it's Massachusetts. Oh, well. Just read you one line out of this Boston Globe story, Doomsday Defense Cuts. Not surprisingly, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta has described the automatic defense cuts as the doomsday mechanism. And, you know, he went on to say that better we take that money out of Medicare, Medicaid. So this is what we're facing here in America today. We have no party fighting for the interest of the American people. It's what I call 21st century feudalism. You know, because I grew up in this Air Force family, we moved around. We lived in England and we lived in Germany for 3 years each. And when I was young, I got to see a lot of castles. I got to learn about Robin Hood. And, you know, the castles almost always were up on top of a hill. And down at the bottom of the hill, usually there was a little thatched hut village. And their job was to serve the lords and masters at the top of the hill in the castles. And so that's kind of the way I see things, you know, through that lens, through that perspective. And so that's kind of what it feels like to me in America today. Increasingly, we have the lords and masters running the Congress to the benefit of the corporate elite, the oligarchy. And the people in our little thatched hut villages, if you will, our job is to serve their interests, which means, in this case, fight their wars so that they can extract declining resources around the world to the benefit of the corporations. So, as I like to say, we're basically behind the eight ball. How do we get out from behind the eight ball?
On that teaser, we'll have to end for now. We'll have the rest of Bruce's talk next week. Thanks for listening to New World Notes. See our website for great links, pretty pictures, and an archive of past shows. And it's all free. That's newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illigitimae non carborundum, and ciao.